The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the movie review podcast where... Oh, no! Godzilla!
Don't you mean, hooray, Godzilla!
I wasn't expecting Godzilla today, because normally...
No one expects the Godzilla
revolution. Wait, turn that off.
That was on me, that's you.
Was that your... No! Yes. Oh, it was! Oh, my God! Okay, so here's the deal.
All right.
First off, we have our Godzilla podcast every Friday, but there is a brand new Godzilla movie, and we're reviewing it on this show.
That's right.
This week, on Critically Acclaimed, we are reviewing Godzilla Minus One, Candy Cane Lane, Silent Night, and Eileen. The first week in December is often a little lean, and we're certainly experiencing one of those. But I had been undergoing some technical difficulties. I had to use an old computer, and my computer that was in the shop just came back today, and they basically were able to save nothing. The only thing they were able to save was the stickers. So I'm still changing all of the settings and getting them all correct. So let me see if I can make sure that that doesn't happen again. But in any case, yeah, it's good to be back. If you're wondering like why some of our Patreon episodes are a little late, it's because they were on this computer's like version of GarageBand, and my old computer wasn't good enough to update to the right version of GarageBand, and it wouldn't let me access all the files. A couple of podcasts are coming soon. Whitney.
Yes.
Hi.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm pretty good.
That's cute, man. I'm
kind of still, even though it was a week ago, still recovering a little bit from Thanksgiving. Because we went out of town for Thanksgiving and got on planes and drove around a lot and drove from Las Vegas to Los Angeles, which is like a 7-hour drive because traffic was so bad when we hit the road.
It's an exhausting time of year in general, but all that travel's got to make it worse.
I'll say this. If you live in Los Angeles and you drive to LA, you drive to Las Vegas, you take the 15. It's the freeway.
Yeah, it's been a long time,
And you're going to pass through certain checkpoints. You're going to pass through Barstow.
Yep.
You're going to pass through Baker, California.
Yep. That's the Fear and Loathing path.
Yeah,
from Baker to Barstow to Purdue.
Somewhere on the edge of the desert when the drugs will begin to take hold. No, Baker is the site of Alien Fresh Jerky.
Ah, yes.
You've seen a lot of the billboards.
I had clam jerky there once. Not as good as it sounds. And it sounds bad.
Clam jerky sounds revolting.
They will jerk anything at Alien Jerky, by God.
Not anything. Elbow. No, I'm sorry. That was terrible.
That was terrible.
But they also have the world's largest thermometer. That's the big tourist attraction.
Mm.
And you'll see billboards for hundreds of miles in either direction for either Peggy Sue's 50s Diner or the Mad Greek.
Yep. I've actually never been to either of those.
For the first time, I'm in my mid-40s, have now eaten at the Mad Greek.
Have you eaten at Peggy Sue?
Not at Peggy Sue.
Is the Mad Greek worth stopping at?
It is. Okay. I get the idea with the Mad... It's not just because... You know, Baker is just this one stretch, and that has, like, you know, gas stations and Jack in the Box and, you know, Taco Bell, the usual garbage.
A place where people go through rather than spend a lot of time visiting. Yeah,
I would love to meet somebody who lives in Baker.
Oh,
but
yeah.
The Mad Greek, little Greek fast food restaurant, you get some falafel. Really good.
Yeah.
And they have kittens. There's a little patio. It was enclosed. They said, don't open the door too quickly because there's little kittens in there.
Yeah.
You go out there and there's little kittens. So you can have Greek food, pet some kittens, and then hit the road.
You win.
That's everything you need when you're on like a really long road trip.
That's everything you need today. Like, who could ask for anything more? Rhythm, music, pa. Give me some Greek food and
kittens. Kittens and falafel, and I'm great.
Nice. So yeah, let's just jump right in. Let's review some motion pictures. Now, again, on our show, Thank Godzilla, It's Friday, where we review a new Godzilla movie every Friday. We do that in order. We will eventually get to Godzilla Minus Zero, like, I think, or in June.
Godzilla Minus One.
I'm sorry, Godzilla Minus One. Godzilla Minus Zero would just be Zero. Godzilla Minus Zero would just be Godzilla. Okay, thank you. But we're gonna do like a whole like hour really dissecting the hell out of Godzilla Minus One when we get to that on that show. It is a new release. It's doing rather well. It's actually got a pretty big. It's made over like $10 million, which is pretty good for an international.
Third at the box office, which is high for a Godzilla picture.
Well, yeah. For any international release to just first weekend get like over $10 million. In America is unusual. Yeah. It's cool though.
Yeah, I feel like we've turned some sort of corner. I think we're back at a point where I think interesting films are going to start coming out again from like major studios.
Yeah,
because ordinarily, like for the last decade, you'd go on the social medias. First of all, social media is collapsing like a flan in a cupboard. But the conversation was all about the big pop blockbusters.
Yeah, as it often was.
Often was, but you log on these days, and there's a lot of really impassioned conversations being had about May-December.
Yeah. So granted, like, that is your feed.
I understand this is my feed, and everyone's feed is completely different, and it's not an accurate depiction of any kind of reality or consensus.
Right.
But where I once saw discussions of just the minutia of superhero movies or what's going to come up in Star Wars is now being occupied by Todd Haynes. And I like that.
I like that a lot too. I finally caught up with May December, by the way, and you were right. It is exceptional.
Yeah.
It's probably going to make my best of the year list, but still a little early. But yeah, no, we had, and this is, and we're just talking about the entertainment industry. The people who write about, podcast about, make YouTube videos about, TikToks about, movies for a big, if not for a living, then certainly for a big part of what they do, have really been chasing after what people are interested in hearing about. And there are certainly people like us who will do stuff that no one gives a shit about. We had a podcast once that was all about like different people watching My Dinner with Andre. We are not chasing SEO. But a lot of people do, and certainly it's part of, you know, the industry. And we'll do things like, you know, oh, is there a new show like this out, and there's like a similar Cancel Too Soon show? We'll do a tie-in, but it's been driven by the same movies, the same types of movies. Not exclusively superhero movies, but franchise movies, nostalgia movies, you know, Disney animated movies. There's been a very particular...
So, not to put too fine a point on it, but things teenage boys are into.
Well, that's always been the demographic ever since, like, American International started changing sort of the paradigm. But we kept focusing on and making endless amounts of articles and shows about the same types of movies over and over again. It was inevitable, and frankly, I'm amazed it lasted so long, that there would eventually be a little bit of a cool-off of interest.
Yeah.
Just because people do become complacent, even if they still like things. It's like that episode...
Even if the movies are still pretty good or entertaining.
It's just, it no longer feels like a special event. It's the Poochie episode of The Simpsons, where what's wrong with Itchy and Scratchy? Why don't kids like love it anymore? It's like there's nothing wrong with it. It's just been that for so long. It's hard to get excited about it. And that's what the entertainment industry is always looking for, something new to get excited about. You and I have talked a lot about how, for example, in like the early 90s, after the slasher boom died out, and the horror genre became kind of unmoored until, like, Scream and the Irony Wave kind of, like, sent it off into the late 90s. But there's, like, a chunk in, like, the early to mid-90s where there was no one trend that everyone was chasing in the horror genre. It wasn't like, oh, we're only doing found footage, or we're only doing J-horror remakes. No, no. Everyone was just trying to figure out what that new thing was, and that was the most exciting time.
So great. You could. And one of my favorite horror movies came out during that time. John Carpenter made In the Mouth of Madness, which is about a Stephen King-like author who's new book has been written, but the publishers don't have it yet. And they hired an insurance investigator. It's a horror movie about an insurance investigator.
Sure.
Played by Sam Neill. And he starts reading these books, and it's implied through a lot of these earlier segments that the books are making people go insane.
Yeah.
Like, they're that scary. Is that a publicity stunt, or is that actually happening?
Yeah.
And we know it's actually happening because there was a prologue where he's in an asylum.
Yeah.
So,
it's a great movie.
And yeah, he goes on a road trip to find this missing author and drives into a town that's fictional, like yeah, that the author
from
wrote.
From his books, yeah. Oh, it's great. And honestly, a lot of my favorite horror movies are from that era. So I know a lot of people are like concerned they like really loved that wave. And, you know, a lot of people, that was kind of like part of their personality for a little while. and can still be, by all means. It's okay. But I think it's exciting to make room for new things to sort of take up space.
Yeah.
And if what's going to take up space is a somewhat more mature approach to not just dramatic films like May December, but films like Godzilla.
Uh-huh. Well, just
that's great, because Godzilla Minus One is a mature, interesting drama with Godzilla in it and a whole bunch of badass Godzilla stuff. It really is the dream. It's the intelligent, it's the intelligent blockbuster that operates on an intelligent level and also gives you those blockbuster kicks.
It's really good about the blockbuster kicks, I'll give you that. Godzilla Minus One it's sort of a pity that they didn't continue with the Shin Godzilla continuity. Instead of doing that, they just did Shin Other Properties. This year also saw Shin Ultraman and Shin Master Rider. Those both came out this year
in
the United States.
Really good, especially Ultraman. Ultraman is great.
I need to finish Ultraman. I saw like 20 minutes of Ultraman and had to turn it off.
No,
so
you've,
then
you've seen
to
nothing because it's very episodic. So, it goes in so many wild
directions.
All
I know is that they used like vintage music, so it feels really authentic, but it's like modern special effects.
It's great.
I loved everything I've seen so far, but I can't really review it or comment on it.
You should get around to it sometime.
But yeah, Toho is back with another Godzilla continuity. This is Godzilla Minus One. It's set prior to the events of the original Godzilla. It's set in the starts in the mid 40s.
Yeah, and it's not a prequel. This is a different sort of continuity.
Yeah,
yeah.
And in this continuity, Godzilla already exists, but he's a little guy. That is to say, he's only about 15 feet tall.
He's like the size of like the original King Kong. Like
pretty
big, but not gonna stomp on a skyscraper big.
And the movie is actually about a kamikaze pilot from World War II who has returned from his mission. Well, I guess he didn't do his mission then.
Exactly, and there's a lot of emotions about that.
And he feels really guilty about he wasn't able to fulfill his duty to his country and sacrifice his life bravely. Yeah. And when he lands that at sort of this little tiny island, just sort of say, well, I guess I kind of failed everything. And the engineers there is like, how dare you that you didn't fulfill your mission? That's when Godzilla attacks.
Yeah.
Kills everybody on the island.
Yep.
Except for this guy. So not only did he fail his mission, but now he has survivor's guilt.
And it's not just that he was there. They were like, get in your plane. Your plane is the only like guns big enough to stop him from killing us. He gets in the plane and then he freezes up. So he really feels like it's his fault.
Yeah.
He returns, we cut to a couple years later, it's after the war, and, you know, the country is a wreck.
Devastated,
He goes home, his family home is obliterated, his parents are dead, his neighbors lost all of her family, and he just chances upon a young woman and a baby. It's not even her baby, she just, someone just gave this baby to her, say, please take care of this baby, and then they're gone. For a few years, they kind of start a life together, but he refuses to emotionally connect with her and even admit that they are in love or, at the very least, so partnered up that they would want to get married.
More than anything, like, rather than just sort of having a stymied romance, he's withdrawn from humanity.
Yeah.
And just because of his war trauma, and he represents what the nation's going through. His inner devastation matches the devastation around him.
Yeah.
Off camera, Godzilla is irradiated and grows to an enormous size.
It's not entirely off camera. There's like a little tiny boom, here's Godzilla's eye, we're done.
Yeah, like it's completely perfunctory, just that the Godzilla grows to enormous size. And now that Godzilla's an enormous size and also irradiated, it goes stomping through all the buildings. There's some really exciting destruction montages that we don't get from a lot of Not even the American Godzilla films have sequences like this anymore.
The American Godzilla movies of late, the MonsterVerse ones, they don't seem to relish in the carnage. And I think, you know, you look at the Gareth Edwards film, and it's got one, it's one of those, it's not directly in the wake of 9/11, but it does feel like that tone, that post 9/11, there's nothing entertaining about this. This is pure horror.
Yeah.
Kind of, there's a place for that. But that is definitely something that is, even this movie, which is very serious, understands, we want to see Godzilla fuck some shit up.
And Godzilla is a lot, has a lot more human features this time around. Godzilla has bigger, more expressive, angry eyes. Godzilla has, like, very human, almost sexy shoulders. Like, has, like, big human, like, arms and gigantic feet.
Yeah. It's almost like, even though it's a CGI creation, they want you to think that they could have put a guy in a suit.
A bit,
dimensions, yeah.
Like, you compare this Godzilla to Shin Godzilla. That Shin Godzilla was, like...
A monster.
Yeah, it was, like...
like an actual wild sea creature.
You couldn't, like, wrap your head around it. Like, it actually showed up first in the movie as something without arms and legs.
Yeah.
It was just this big fish with dead eyes flopping around, spewing, red glop all over the streets.
I was not ready for that. I was so used to what Godzilla, like, looked like. The idea of not just seeing, like, a younger Godzilla or, like, a Godzilla who isn't fully mutated yet, but just a Godzilla who isn't fully formed.
Yeah.
It's such a strange choice. Great, though. It worked amazing. It really sticks.
And then when the Godzilla sort of evolves, even Godzilla grows arms, but they're vestigial. There's just these little branches. Godzilla breathes nuclear breath, but like his head almost comes off in Shin Godzilla. Like there's like no brain in there almost. It's like this weird mindless force of radiation.
Yeah.
This one's a lot more of a human monster. It's a lot more like Jaws, really, where they give it a lot of like sinister personality. And indeed, there's a sequence where Godzilla swims after a tugboat that's firing guns at him.
Actually, a lot of this movie takes place at sea, because that's where Godzilla's attacking a lot of boats, and that's where they think they can actually sort of get the upper hand on Godzilla in the second half of the movie. But I don't want to go into too much detail on that. I think you're overselling the humanity of Godzilla in this one, because I really do think it's less... Because we've seen Godzilla with humanity. We've seen Godzilla literally, like, talk with speech bubbles in, like, the Showa-era Godzilla, which we've talked about on Thank Godzilla It's Friday, which is really funny and kind of fun, but it's a very goofy version of Godzilla. This version of Godzilla, it has a personality, but it's a pissed-off personality. It's just a pissed-off monster, but it has... There's this one bit where, like, it's attacking a city... And it, like, there's, like, an elevated train that goes by, and Godzilla kind of plays with it. Like, well, he's kind of interested in it, you know?
There's a famous image of Godzilla. It was a publicity photo from 1954 of Godzilla eating a train.
Yeah.
Like, holding a one train car in one hand and, like...
Eating, like, a Snickers.
Some trains, like, sort of hanging from its jaws.
Yeah.
Which isn't in the movie.
No.
That image was made for publicity, and I feel like...
This is like an homage to that.
It's like an homage to that original poster, where he picks up an elevated train and starts snacking on it.
I love the thing that they do for Godzilla's fire breath in this movie, where, like, all of, like, the spikes on his back, like, pop up.
Yeah.
Because it's so charged with energy, his spikes go, like, and stick out more. I love that. It's such a... There's so much detail in this movie. His, like, actual, like, period piece detail. It's a handsome production. It looks very convincing. But also just the monster itself. There's a lot of very particular... It's not just, like, just throw a bunch of generalities out there. They're, like, really thought through every different element. But here's the thing, and this is the thing that makes Godzilla Minus One, I think, one of the best Godzilla movies. Now, I've only seen, in my defense... Not even my defense. I apologize. I've only seen 24 Godzilla movies. There's a few we haven't gotten to, and Thank Godzilla It's Friday that I've seen, but like I've counted just to be sure. I've seen 24 of these suckers. That's not enough. There's so many. We're getting to it. We're going to get to it. But of the ones I've seen, this is one of the best. A lot of people are saying this is the best. I think it might be a little... that's a little...
Premature, maybe. Yeah.
Maybe a little premature. But I do think it belongs in the conversation with the original Gojira and Shin Godzilla, which to me were the gold standard before this. Those are all movies which have the devastation, have the destruction, have like the production value, if you will. but are actually also about something, have something interesting on their mind, and explore it using Godzilla as part of the narrative, as opposed to just getting Godzilla to kick a bunch of ass and, like, tacking something on, which even some of the really fun ones do that, like, the ones I like. It's not particularly pointed storytelling, but it is a lot of fun. Godzilla Minus One is a great example of showing that you can do both. And this is actually one of the Godzilla movies where the human characters are not just interesting enough to, like, really warrant spending a lot of time with them, because sometimes they're not. They're interesting enough that if Godzilla never showed up, I'd want to see their movie.
All right.
Like, I think it would be a kind of a simple, straightforward melodrama.
Mm.
But I do think the performances are really good. I think they understand sort of the emotional crux of it. And also sort of the historical context of it, of a nation rebuilding and reckoning with, you know, this is a kamikaze pilot who becomes to believe over the course of the film that maybe his destiny is to fulfill that.
Mm-hmm.
That's a concern. That's a suspense element in the film. But the movie also acknowledges, what does it say that an entire, like, country said that was heroism?
Yeah.
And well, can they now move past that? I think that's really interesting.
What's going on is we've been watching all these Godzilla movies, and in most of them, especially through the second half of the Showa era, and we've talked about a lot about this,
which is the first era, by the way.
We don't care about those pesky human characters.
For the most part, no.
We want Godzilla. We like Godzilla. He's our hero now.
Yeah.
Humanity is really pushed off to the side in those movies. The story is perfunctory or not given enough attention or just nonsensical.
Yeah, a lot of the times it's just pure nonsense.
Yeah.
Which can be fun, but it's pure nonsense.
I happen to like that breed of nonsense, but it's nonsense.
Yeah.
This Godzilla movie is one of the first that really kind of highlights humanity and the triumph of the human spirit. Humanity taking bold action to stop a force of destruction and kind of redeem themselves, which to my eye makes it kind of boring. It turns it into just sort of really typical off the rack action thriller motivations that I've seen in 100 other movies before. I'm going to do something bold and heroic, and we're going to do all this, like, cool action stuff. And it's a perfectly decent action thriller, which is a little bit odd for Godzilla. We don't get a lot of Godzillas that have a tone like this, that is actually really quick moving and predicated on action and
character drama kind of driving as well.
Exactly, and character drama. So that's novel for a Godzilla film, and I can see why a lot of American audiences are reacting positively to it. It feels American.
It's kind of American. Yeah,
deals with
which we've seen before.
It deals with Japanese wartime trauma. It deals with kamikaze pilots. It deals with a lot of Japanese concepts. But in terms of its tone and execution, it feels like an American action thriller, and not to the point where it feels like that rotten Roland Emmerich film from 1998.
Oh, heavens no. Like, it's a classy Hollywood-type thriller. Yeah.
But it's a Hollywood thriller.
I see your point.
And I think that's slightly less interesting than something they did with, like, Shin Godzilla, where Godzilla is actually a terrifying monster, and it's about bureaucracy failing to stop a natural disaster. Or in that case, it's like a metaphor for Fukushima.
Right. You know, you bring up an interesting point, which is that, you know, of the three, you know, probably most acclaimed Godzilla movies, and I'll include this in that list, Gojira and Shin Godzilla are comparatively very cynical films.
Yeah.
Gojira was about, okay, so...
Well, they're both about destruction.
Well, they're both about destruction, but, you know, whereas Shin Godzilla was about sort of the failure of bureaucracy, it's a very... as far as politics goes, it's a very critical film. It's criticizing it. Gojira was about how the creation of Godzilla was something that could only be stopped by essentially the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction on a nuclear scale. They invented a weapon for that movie that didn't exist, but they treated it with that same severity. Even to destroy Godzilla, do we dare use it?
Yeah.
And at the end of the movie, when... spoiler, they defeat Godzilla. it's sad.
Yeah.
Not just because Godzilla was just some monster that was, you know, dangerous and had to be dealt with in some capacity.
They kind of sold themselves out.
They sold their souls, essentially. Yeah. There is a darkness to that. And is seen as a tragic end. It's not a happy ending. It's really sad that it led to this. Mm. Shin Godzilla has a slightly different attitude, but it is a very cynical attitude. You're right. Godzilla Minus One is comparatively hopeful. It is not about, but it's also about, but this is the thing I think is kind of interesting. And I think I'm hesitant to treat positivity or hopefulness or optimism as superficial or less than. I think optimism, when tempered with a dose of reality, can be incredibly powerful. Optimism doesn't have to be a denial of reality. Optimism can be an acknowledgement of reality and still believing it's possible to be better and still actively trying to do that. And I think what's happening in Godzilla Minus One is the characters in this movie, you know, they could go down the path that Gojira went through. Mm. So they could just retell that story if they really wanted to, but they don't. And there's actually a pointed effort to solve this problem in a way that the nation can be proud of. And that's a rewriting of Godzilla history. And honestly, I think it is indicative of, even in these incredibly bleak times in which we live, a nugget of hope that doesn't feel like a lie.
Okay, contrived.
It doesn't feel, I mean, it is contrived because it's a melodrama, but like, it feels earned. It feels like what the characters have been through isn't making that cheap. And I think that is incredibly satisfying right now. I think we're at a point where we need, or at least we're looking for, hope that we can believe in and not just view as escapism. And I think Godzilla Minus One does an admirable job of tempering that optimism with enough genuine drama, horror, and acknowledgement of what actually happened in World War II.
I suppose I agree to an extent. That said, the filmmaking is a little corny. I'm not just talking about the concept of optimism. I'm talking about the way the film was made, and the way it presents its optimism is a little bit...
sometimes more than others, I'll grant you. There's a little bit
over the top.
There's a bit at the end where I was like, okay, that feels like a Hollywood studio.
We don't need a lot of like hurrah moments, you know.
Yeah, there's a couple of moments that feel a little bit more contrived than others. I'll give you that, but I don't think the movie revolves around.
No. But it's a deeply satisfying movie.
Yeah,
satisfying doesn't necessarily mean a great movie. There are pieces of garbage that are satisfying.
That's true. There's also a lot of pieces of garbage that aren't.
Yeah,
to be fair. That's true. So, just because the movie is cynical doesn't make it good.
No. Yeah. It's all in the telling, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
But I really liked Godzilla Minus One. It's not one of my favorites, though. But I'm understanding why Americans are responding to it the way they are.
Godzilla, you know, now that I've been watching so much Godzilla, and I have grown to appreciate the many facets of the character and how different filmmakers have treated Godzilla differently over different eras, and there's still a few bits of that I'm unfamiliar with. I've come to view Godzilla a little bit like I've come to view something like Star Trek.
Okay.
And these are very long-lasting sort of pop culture touchstones. And the reason why they endure and have endured, in Godzilla's case, about 70 years, and in Star Trek's case, closer to 60, but still, is because the central core concept can withstand new generations and new perspectives without being just thrown out the window.
Yeah.
There's a few, you know, characters and things who, like, you know, now that we're in the age that we're in, it's kind of hard to justify why we would need that character. What relevance does that character have for today? Godzilla
is James Bond for you.
James Bond is an example of a character who feels like a relic. They joked about that way back in the 90s.
Yeah, he was a relic in the 90s.
Yeah, and they were accurate in that. And you could tell the Pierce Brosnan movies were kind of struggling to come up with a justification for why Bond exists now. And some of those movies are like fun, but most of them, they all feel a little pointless, except for GoldenEye.
I feel like they should have made GoldenEye.
Yeah.
And then just shut the series off there. Yeah. Like, we were good.
I still think the trick is period piece.
Just set it in the
60s. Set in the 60s.
Which is what they did with Godzilla. They went back again.
Exactly. I think because that context makes even more sense than other things. But I do think Godzilla is malleable enough as a creation that you can have the deeply bitter, cynical Shin Godzilla. You can have this somewhat grounded, but also melodramatic and satisfying sort of hopeful Godzilla. Mm. And then you can have the American, you know, absolute fucking nonsense Godzilla. Which
government conspiracies and stuff.
Like, it went from, like, the first one, which had a lot of problems, but it wanted you to take it seriously, to, did you know that the Earth is hollow and full of monsters and also the sky?
Like, start there.
what are we doing now? It's so nonsense. You know, but, like, it looks ridiculous. The new one just released a trailer as of this recording, and it looks fucking ridiculous.
Yeah.
It looks I half expected Godzilla and King Kong to high five. Because they're gonna fight Godzilla together.
Godzilla X Kong.
Which admittedly is something we haven't seen. We've seen Godzilla fight King Kong a few times. We've never seen them, aside from like Mecha Godzilla at the end of like the most recent Godzilla versus Kong. Or Kong versus Godzilla, I guess.
No, it was Godzilla versus Kong.
I always get confused. Aside from like a little bit there. Like, we've never seen him, like, be pals, because canonically, Godzilla's best pal is Anguirus.
Yes.
But Anguirus has not been introduced in the Legendary Monsterverse. So there's a void.
Right.
So Godzilla can be best pals with King Kong.
Yeah, they hang out.
Isn't that nice? Anyway, that's Godzilla Minus One. It's a good movie, though. I even though I liked it more than you. I think it's really good.
It's really good. I think you should see it. But yeah, it's not the best.
Fair enough. It's that time of year. They're coming out with a lot of Christmas movies, and as I'm sure people who've been listening to this show for a while can recall, I often go out of my way to watch the Christmas movies, even the ones that other critics are happily ignoring, much to Whitney's absolute chagrin. But this week is a little different. This week, Whitney saw one and I didn't.
And I'm one of those cynical bastards who does not go out of his way to see Christmas movies.
Just in general.
Yeah. Like, I...
You don't have that one you watch every year.
And there was a span there where I watched The Nightmare Before Christmas, but that was more around Halloween time.
Yeah, and that's it's kind of a two-for-one deal
But yeah, I don't have, like, a go-to Christmas film. I guess there's, like, some TV special, like Charlie Brown.
Sure.
Gotta watch Charlie Brown.
Okay.
Every once in a while. But
every once in a while, I see that like put on a list of the best Christmas movies, and I'm like, it's a short.
It was a TV short. Yeah.
It's kind of drawn. It's on the line there. I guess tie goes to the runner. But
there's a lot of people who say, does Die Hard count as a Christmas film? It's not explicitly about Christmas, but it's set at Christmas. Most people have generally agreed that it is. I will argue that it is not. In fact, nothing is, because there are no Christmas movies. There are none. They've all been put to an end. The debate is now over. There are no such things as Christmas movies anymore.
Do we have December movies?
There are films that are released in December. That's as far as I'll go.
Okay, so May-December is not a December movie.
May-December was released in November.
That's just a lie.
So they fucked up.
Yeah, it's like when Hocus Pocus came out in July. What are you doing to us?
or when Tim Burton's Sleepy Hollow came out.
Like the first week of November?
The week after Halloween? Yeah, it's like, God. You put that out like week before Halloween. Absolutely. What are you doing?
And a lot of like the most famous Christmas movies, I think It's a Wonderful Life came out in the summer.
I think Gremlins was a June release. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
This one is a Christmas movie. It's released in the first weekend of December. It's called Candy Cane Lane.
Yeah.
It's from the director of that Sidney Poitier documentary from last year.
Really?
As well as the film Boomerang. So he's worked with Eddie Murphy.
Oh, it's Reggie Hudlin.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, he also like wrote Black Panther.
He's been working in Hollywood for a long time.
Yeah.
He's made a Christmas movie with Eddie Murphy. Eddie Murphy's kind of back. He was in semi-retirement there for a second because his movies weren't doing well. Films like A Thousand Words and Meet Dave were nobody was going to see him.
He was on a really bad streak. But then, like, he, you know, got a few good roles again. You know, Dolomite is My Name, which he should have been Oscar nominated for. That's a great fucking movie.
Everybody's great in Dolomite.
But, wonderful movie.
This is a typical family fare with a lot of special effects and a lot of, comedians that you might recognize. And,
What is the premise?
Okay.
Because the only thing I've heard a lot of radio spots for this for some reason, just totally random. And it seems like we're going to decorate the house for Christmas and that's it.
So Eddie Murphy and his family, his wife is played by Tracy Ellis Ross.
Okay.
They live on, you know, typical suburban street in, I think they live in El Segundo, California.
Okay.
And they have a contest on their street, and it's been announced that whoever wins this contest this year will get $100,000 from a sponsor.
Okay.
Big cash prize. Which Eddie Murphy has to work very, very hard to get because he's just been laid off from his job. He just got laid off. Now he needs the money, and now he needs to work really hard to beat his evil neighbor, played by Ken Marino.
I do like Ken Marino.
He's actually not evil. He's actually very affable, but he's favored to win.
Got it.
So he goes out shopping for Christmas decor, and he finds this mysterious building that had never been there before, underneath a freeway. And inside is a woman named Pepper, who's dressed like an elf, and is played by Jillian Bell, who I adore.
Oh, she's wonderful.
I love Jillian Bell. She is unbearably hilarious.
Yep.
And he pays a bunch of money and gets a 12 Days of Christmas, like 20-foot-tall Christmas tree decoration to put on his lawn. And it spins, and it looks like it's animated. And wouldn't you know it, when he got this thing, he signed a receipt to get it. It turns out he was signing a contract.
Okay.
And when the next morning, all of the 12 Days of Christmas have escaped.
Okay, so it's a 12 Days of Christmas movie.
So it's a 12 Days of Christmas movie, where the literal beings from the song 12 Days of Christmas begin running amok in El Segundo, and he has to gather them back up and gather together the magical rings from the five gold rings.
Okay.
So that he can restore his fulfill his contract and fulfill or escape an evil fate that this evil Jillian Bell character has put out on him.
They really should have called this 12 Days of Christmas. Or Candy Cane Lane tells me nothing. That could be Christmas with the Cranks for all I know. Yeah,
and the thing is, we have this kind of sinister elf character played by Jillian Bell, and she plays it like, you know, it's really chewing scenery.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, signing contracts, and we actually see what happens because he sneaks around and he sees these little Hummel figurines, these little clay people living in a little Christmas diorama in the shop. And when he looks long enough, he starts seeing them move around and they start to talk and they become major characters in the movie. One of them is voiced by Nick Offerman.
Okay.
It turns out there were people who failed to fulfill their contracts. So now they're doomed
to be... Oh, so there's consequences.
Yeah.
Stakes.
Yeah, yeah. There's a horror element to that.
Sounds like.
Like, it could be kind of scary. And this film doesn't lean into the horror elements at all.
I can imagine not.
It's not terribly funny either, so it doesn't really lean into the comedy of it either. It's just sort of like this affable, pretty watchable, slickly made fantasy family adventure that you can watch with the kids.
The thing that I wonder, because you know, I'm not shocked to find it's not particularly funny. A lot of comedy, especially family comedies, are trying to get by on amiable.
Yeah.
If you don't laugh, that's okay. As long as you don't frown, we'll say you got your money's worth. Like, that's where we're at. But the premise, it's an elevator pitch. What if the 12 Days of Christmas were like a magical force that like got out, like Jumanji or something? Theoretically, what you're here to see is the fun and games of that. All of that actually like doing something. But a lot of them is just like, you know, geese.
I appreciate that the three French hens. One of them was wearing like a striped shirt and a beret.
Okay, that's funny.
It's a
Cackney cliche, but it's kind of funny.
It'd be a cute
image, I imagine. Are the lords a leaping?
They're like a Korean dance troupe, and they do like backflips. They're okay. leaping about. It's pretty cool.
That, man, that doesn't sound like it's a lot of chaos. It just sounds kind of fun.
The maids of milking can like fill entire rooms with milk and drown people, that kind of stuff.
Okay, yeah. That makes me laugh. I don't know why that makes me laugh. It's like Hydro Man, but he's Milkman.
Yeah,
you know, like okay, that's vaguely funny.
Mm.
Okay,
vaguely, and
yeah.
And he had, the Eddie Murphy character has three kids. They're all named after Christmas thing. Like one of them is named Holly. His wife is named Carol. That kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And they each have their own dramas. The son is failing at math. Mm. His math teacher is played by, in one scene, Stephen Tobolowsky.
Hey!
Wonderful supporting actor who's like rarely has a lead in anything. Always a good like nerdy supporting guy. Like that's been his career.
If you can't picture him, he was Ned Ryerson in Groundhog Day.
That's right.
Ned Ryerson!
And he gets punched in the face.
Yeah, yeah. One of the best punches ever because Bill Murray doesn't...
Ned! Punch!
Yeah. But then... Tobolowsky knows how to take a fucking punch because what he does...
he kind of wheels back a little bit.
He wheels back and then flings his face in front of the camera. It's like it's almost like a... It's not a 360. It's like a 270. And it is the no one has ever taken a punch better in a movie. Ever in the history of movies. It's the greatest movie punch, at the very least in terms of the recipient.
Stephen Tobolowsky directed a film about himself once. It's called Stephen Tobolowsky's Birthday Party.
Yeah.
And it's about, like... these character actors in Hollywood who only ever play like these tiny supporting roles.
Yeah.
But they do that a lot. The hey, it's that guy actors.
Yeah.
Stephen Tobolowsky's in it very briefly.
Yeah.
But the son is failing his math class because he really wants to pursue music. And okay. His dad.
What grade is his class? Is he?
He's like a senior in high school.
Okay. Then yeah, fuck it. You can totally slack off on math. Yeah. if you understand your basic addition, multiplication, fractions, and by senior year you've decided what you want to do with your life and it isn't architecture or something, fine. Skip out on trig. You're not going to use it.
But he hasn't been telling his parents that he's been failing, and which is an issue. And his teenage daughter is a track star. She wants to go across country. She wants to go to Notre Dame.
Okay.
Whereas he's a USC guy and thinks that she's going to stay in town, and he has to confront his bad dad stuff. I'm so fucking sick of bad dads in movies.
And Eddie Murphy's
like,
played them a lot.
As essentially as like a really go-to theme in terms of family comedies. Dads are a really common theme. And
the assumption is that everyone in the audience goes, yeah, my dad sucks.
Well, I think the assumption is, I always sense something a lot more cynical going on, because I feel like the people who make these movies are like executives who are workaholics and aren't at home with their kids.
And a lot of filmmakers, really labor intensive, you know?
So I imagine this is sort of like a karmic make good for these workaholic dads who are making these movies away from their kids.
Mm-hmm.
And so they decide to make movies about dads who are away from their kids or neglectful parents in some way. They're never abusive or alcoholic parents.
No, they're just mildly negligent. I agree with you, and I always find that a little like suspicious how often that very specific dad, because there are other stories you can tell with dads.
And it's never bad moms. Well, it's rarely bad moms.
And oftentimes it's more of like the evil stepmother. Like it's not about like redeeming them after they magically turn into something or other. It's usually about how dad needs to marry someone else or something. It's terrible. The one that I find deeply, even more cynical than that, are all of the big Hollywood movies about, like, people who are, like, and oftentimes it overlaps with the bad dad genre, people who are trying to make a lot of money, pursue a career, you know, make something of themselves and, like, you know, actually be able to, like, take care of their family in perpetuity, and how they learn that that's bad and that they should be okay with very little. And I'm like, coming from millionaires, that is one hell of a fucking message to try to sell us right now. Like, hey, listen, you know what sucks way more than having no money? Having all the money in the world, because you know what? We choose not to spend a lot of time with our kids. That's way worse. You can spend so much more time with your kids because you have no money. It's not like that requires you to hustle more in order to make ends meet.
What are you going to do with those kids with no money? Yeah, and to feed them.
So out of touch.
There's another side of that where if you took another Christmas movie about a bad dad, Jingle All the Way.
Oh God, one of the worst.
Abysmal. What people? People with terrible taste like it.
People who are eight when it came out.
Yeah, fuck them. I think it was Alonzo Duralde has coined the phrase. Was it great or were you eight? Did you just see it when you were 8 years old and it left an impression on you?
Yeah.
Or is it a legitimately great movie?
And sometimes it's both.
Sometimes it's both.
Yeah.
Often it isn't.
No, in the case of Jingle All the Way, that is a... That is... We did a podcast about this once. Jingle All the Way, which is a story about a guy who forgot to get his kid the most popular Christmas gift of the year and is trying to, like, dash around town doing increasingly unethical things to try to get it on the day before Christmas. That is the, like, Hollywood remake of Bicycle Thieves.
Yeah.
It's literally, the dad is, like, trying to, like, be a good dad, but he's only doing it for capitalistic reasons. Except, in Bicycle Thieves, it was justified because
he was impoverished.
Because they were impoverished. This guy's fucking rich.
Well, and that's what I was going to bring up.
Also, he gets the happy ending in this one, which is bullshit.
He's a workaholic dad. He's been working really... I think he's like a mattress salesman or something like that.
Yeah, something domestic. And, like selling a product, yeah.
Yeah, he's some kind of salesman. And clearly it's enough to afford a really nice home in the suburbs.
Yeah, they're not hurting.
So, he's a workaholic dad, yeah, because he was making a lot of money and he's providing very well for his family.
Yeah. The only thing he wasn't doing was he was giving his kid false promises and not following through. Mm. He doesn't need to go through something magical to become a better dad. Mm. That's a very easy fix. Just fucking follow through.
Go to your kid's martial arts match or whatever he missed.
Anyway, fucking ridiculous. I don't... Yeah.
So this is not nearly as bad as Jingle All the Way. Few things are.
Okay,
It's like I said, it's pretty slick. The special effects are really cool. I love Jillian Bell. There's a wonderful cameo by Santa Claus. I won't tell you who played Santa Claus.
Is it like, that makes sense? Or is it like, I didn't see that casting coming?
More like, oh, that's fun.
Okay.
Look back on In Living Color and you'll find Santa.
Okay.
You probably figured out who it is already.
Yeah.
But he's very good at Santa. Comedian I very much like from In Living Color plays Santa.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of other fun comedians are in there besides. It seems pretty perfunctory. Eddie Murphy hit it big in the early 80s with films like 48 Hours, Beverly Hills Cop.
Mm. Movies with an edge to him.
Yeah, and you know, he was a pretty edgy comedian. He was known at the time for kind of how foul-mouthed he was.
Yeah. And he's actually gone on record as saying, like, yeah, some of that stuff's not cool anymore.
Oh, a lot of it's aged really poorly, but...
To his credit, though. Yeah. You know, yeah.
But, I mean, that's a lot of comedians who were working in the 80s. They were speaking the language at the time. A lot of it wasn't appropriate by today's standards. It's been unusual to watch him mutate from somebody who had edge to a comedian who was working in, like, high-concept comedies. Mm. Like his Nutty Professor remake. It's not hilarious, but he played multiple characters. That was a shtick for a long time. He played many different characters. He did that in Coming to America. He did that in, any of his films, really.
Yeah, a lot of them, yeah.
He didn't play multiple characters in Dolomite, did he?
No, I don't think so.
Even did it in a Wes Craven movie.
Vampire in Brooklyn.
Speaking of that time in the 90s when everybody was trying to figure out what was going on,
right?
Vampire in Brooklyn. So even though he's making some of these movies aren't great, but he's at least reaching for something. You know, Bowfinger, he played multiple roles in that one.
Oh, that's a great movie.
There's no ambition left for something like Candy Cane Lane. It's really special effects heavy. But it's not a very high concept movie.
Yeah.
Just sort of like this affable family adventure. And there's no reason to have Eddie Murphy in a role like this. He's playing such a bland everyman that it just made me miss his talent. Like, where's the Eddie Murphy who can be funny?
Yeah.
And react to things in a really kind of over the top funny way. He's not in this movie.
I think it's okay for performers to, you know,
they can evolve. They can do whatever they want. But yeah,
you know, calm down if they had a lot of energy. Mm. Like that's not who they are. That's not where they're at right now, creatively or personally. They get a lot less angry a lot of the time.
Mm. My point being, this is a comedy film.
No, I understand that. Sometimes it just feels like, I miss you, man. Where did you go? Like, that's for me, like, Ice Cube.
Yeah.
Like, if you had told me when, like, Ice Cube was just getting started in the industry, like in the late 80s, early 90s, if you had told me that guy would have starred in multiple Are We There Yet movies, I would have been like, no.
Yeah.
Really? Weird. And good for him. I'm sure he seemed to enjoy it, I guess. I'm sure he's happy, but, like, weird, right?
Yeah.
And it's just like, the early stuff was really great. Okay. Anyway, so Gandy Gimlin. There is another Christmas movie we're reviewing this week. And this one is a film from John Woo. Mm-hmm. John Woo is back. He hasn't made a movie in America in about 20 years.
Since Paycheck.
That was his last one.
His last American film. He's made a few films in China since
then. Oh, yeah. He's still been working. But, like, yeah, he hasn't... He was in the 90s when they started, like, bringing a lot of people over from Hong Kong filmmakers like Ringo Lam and Choi Hark, and they started, like, giving them, like, Hollywood projects. For the most part, they were relegated to, like, crappy Jean-Claude Van Damme movies.
Yeah.
That includes John Woo. John Woo was the
hard
one.
Target.
John Woo's Hard Target is such a fucking awesome action movie. It's nonsense, but it's so fucking amazingly directed that it did pretty well, and it got him bigger and bigger projects. And he was, like, the one director from that class of the Hong Kong sort of gung-fu action filmmakers who actually hit it pretty big in America with films like Broken Arrow and Face Off. And then, you know, I had a couple of films that underwhelmed. Mission Impossible 2 was a big hit, actually. People forget that. It's not the best liked one, but it made money.
Well, it's also a terrible movie.
Agreed. I can't really blame John Woo for that, though.
John Woo's American output is pretty abysmal across the board. I haven't seen Broken Arrow.
Broken Arrow's fine. It's not an amazing movie, but it's a good action.
Hard Target has a script that makes no sense whatsoever.
That's so fun.
I adore Face Off, everybody loves Face Off for kind of how stupid the premise is, and they just rolled really hard into it.
They
let these two American actors just sort of overact as much as they wanted. Where John Travolta is playing Nick Cage, and Nick Cage is playing John Travolta. Okay, sold.
You're right. Good. That's the best thing ever.
Just gonna overact a lot.
Finally got through that door, huh?
There's a little kitty there.
And
then he did Mission Impossible 2, which is terrible. And he did Paycheck, which is terrible.
No, he did Windtalkers first.
Of course, Windtalkers. How could I forget Windtalkers?
Which was well-intentioned, but not very good.
Which is about Navajo code speakers during World War II, but they still made it about the white guy.
And
it's directed by John Woo.
Yeah, it's a weird film. And then Paycheck, which is based off of Philip K. Dick story. It's one of my favorite short stories ever written. Mm-hmm. It's fucking great, and it did not even need to be changed to turn into a movie. It wouldn't have had as much action as they wanted in a John Woo movie, but it would have been an incredible sci-fi movie. Yeah. People would have fucking loved it. Paycheck became this weird, bizarre beast, and it's watchable but not very good. But yeah, like John Woo, you know, compared to his earlier stuff, films like The Killer, Hard Boiled, Bullet to the Head, which is sadly harder to find, but it's really, really great. It's like John Woo. What if John Woo did The Deer Hunter? That's basically Bullet to the Head. But here's the thing with John Woo's movies that I think... we think of films like The Killer, which is this really excellent sort of Jean-Pierre Melville, but with amazing action, sort of hitman melodrama. We think of Hard Boiled, which is this really hardcore, over-the-top action movie. But what we forget is that in films like Face Off and What's a Thief and his like early wuxia film Last Hurrah for Chivalry, he's also funny. Like, he's capable of understanding that his over-the-top balletic action can be ridiculous.
Yeah.
And there is something to be enjoyed in that, and it doesn't even necessarily need to undermine the story. You can have both. And I think the better John Woo movies, there's a couple of the serious ones that work really well, but I think the better ones actually have a pretty good marriage of a certain exaggerated, heightened reality and drama and humor, and also, like, some serious character work. So when his new movie, Silent Night, opens with a slow-mo credits sequence of Joel Kinnaman running at the camera for about 3 minutes in slow motion, and the camera keeps lingering on his jingling reindeer sweater that's splashed with blood.
He's got a jingle bell on a necklace, like, yeah, around his neck, and it's, yeah, bouncing.
And he's got Colin Firth's reindeer sweater from Bridget Jones, like that kind of like bad Christmas sweater, and he's like got this angry face. I thought to myself, oh, John Woo knows this is ridiculous. John Woo is actually going to have some fun, and this is going to be a fun movie, and it is not that at all. No. It is grim to the point of being absolutely monotone.
I'm not a huge fan of John Woo. I saw The Killer when it came out in the 90s. It came out in 89.
It came out in America a little bit later.
So I saw it like in the mid-90s and thought it was fine. Sort of...
Did you see like good, the dub?
Good gigantic, operatic kind of action picture. He's very good at a kind of action that I don't care for. That sort of gigantic balletic hospital sequence and Hard Boiled. It's like
lots of slow motion gunfire and things. You're just not an action movie guy, really. At some point,
like, I was watching that movie, Hard Boiled. It's like it made me really sad for reasons I can't really define. No, I mean that was my reaction. It's like I'm watching this, I'm just getting really depressed.
Well, I think part of it is you're actually supposed to be. It's a condemnation.
It's not because of something that's going on in the movie. The movie's doing everything right. I'm just reacting to it, like, and it's just making me sad watching that movie. I'm coming into Silent Night with a little bit of skepticism, because I've also seen Mission Impossible 2 kind of recently. Mm. I also saw his last film, though, which was a Netflix only here in the States.
Oh, I missed that one.
It was called, I think, Manhunt.
Yeah, I missed that one. Was that good?
That was okay. That was like a kind of a modest cop drama. It was less action forward and more sort of intrigue.
When he did an incredible film in 2008. Called Red Cliff.
It was a 5-hour historical epic.
Yeah, absolutely. They like really cut it down for American to like one like kind of 2.5-hour movie. But like, see the original. That movie's fucking amazing. That's a great historical.
That's something I need to get to, because that sounds like kind of like his masterwork, if you want to use that kind of word. But yeah, here he is with Silent Night, and I'm waiting for him to prove himself to me. He has to come to me now. And he stays way over there.
it's a weird project.
This is a premise that I've seen in dozens of action pictures. Mm-hmm. Man's young son is killed.
Yeah.
And we spent a lot of time establishing that.
Mm-hmm. First half hour of the movie is that one plot point.
So it opens with this chase. He's cornered by these really kind of racist caricature characters of Latino gangsters. They shoot him in the neck, and he loses his ability to speak. There's no dialogue in this film.
Yeah,
there's... Which is kind of more of a gimmick than something that's revealing how terse the situation is.
I want to talk about that, because there's a couple of movies lately that have been tried to do sort of a modern silent movie. The sci-fi horror film, No One Will Save You.
Which I love,
That's a great fucking movie. Yeah. I want to talk about what that film does that this film doesn't in a minute. But, like, yeah, so he can't speak. And for no particular reason, no one else in the film does either.
Yeah, there's some incidental dialogue on radios.
Yeah,
but we're trying to tell a story visually, and that's fine. I appreciate that.
In theory, that works.
It's not a detriment at all. Yeah. It just I don't feel like John Woo is doing anything interesting with that.
Yeah.
And so this Joel Kinnaman character decides to get revenge, and he does, and that's all we can really talk about in the plot.
He spends a whole year, like, just prepared, because he's a normal guy. Mm. Like, he's motivated, but he's not, like, you know, he wasn't, like, a special forces guy. He can just pull out his go bag.
Except he's, you know, Joel Kinnaman. He looks like an angry vampire.
So he spends a whole year training, learning guns, learning how to drive a car real cool, learning how to stab people real cool, so that next Christmas... he can kill them all. And that's pretty much the last chunk of the movie.
And in fact, there's a moment, and you say John Woo kind of is aware of how ridiculous a lot of his stuff is.
Often he is.
In this one, I don't think he is. I think he's trying to tell it really straight. And there's a scene where Joel Kinnaman flips forward a calendar and writes on the calendar on Christmas Eve, "Kill them all." Like, that's just on the calendar.
No, it's laughable, right?
Yeah, it's this unbelievably dumb B-movie moment that is sold completely straight.
And that's the thing. Without any... Because this is... when you're doing silent filmmaking, and there's a lot of nuance to silent filmmaking, and there's a lot of really interesting sort of cinematic language you can harken back to. But on some level, you can't employ a lot of the screenwriting tricks that people use today to obfuscate clunky or hackneyed scripts. You can take sort of the skeleton of the most obvious action movie ever, the they killed someone I love and now I'm going to kill them all thing. That's been done to death. I've lost track. I couldn't count how many films I've seen with that basic premise.
But the point is that you
can't like smooth that over with fun dialogue. You have to rely on the actual sequence of events, and those sequence of events are perfunctory. They might be sad, but they're perfunctory.
There's no twist in that. He just sort of sets it up and goes about it and then just kills a bunch of guys.
You don't find out like one guy who like you thought was a good guy was a bad guy or anything like that. There's nothing. It's very straight line.
There's not even a sense that this guy is like losing his soul. Like his wife leaves him in the course of his sort of training to kill all these gangsters.
Yeah.
But there is... I don't get a sense that John Woo thinks this man is turning into a monster. He's actually doing something really kind of badass, and he gets to drive a fast car and murder a bunch of people in a cool way. There's no judgment of this character. Everything he does is totally right. And in fact, John Woo goes out of his way to depict the gangsters as cartoonishly evil.
Yeah.
To the point where they become, like, inhuman and uninteresting.
You know, I look
and, at... And kind of offensive in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I look at this movie and I kept thinking of... There are two movies I kept thinking of as I was watching this. One was Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon.
Okay.
Because that is a movie about a guy who is a slasher movie villain, but it's a documentary about what he does when he isn't killing people. And it's all about him preparing to kill people.
Yeah. And how he sets up the house and how he hides bodies, that kind of stuff.
And I remember watching that movie. It's a great movie. It's really, really funny. It actually has like a bit more like character and like stakes and everything that you might think, because it's not just a fun premise. They do a lot with it, but it made me think about like just how much all these like revenge movie action movies that we've got are essentially a slasher, except all the victims are people the audience is supposed to think deserves it.
Yeah, which you could argue that's also a lot of slasher movies.
Well, that's fair enough. But like, but my point is, it's not just like they deserve it because they're assholes or because they're bad boyfriends or something. They're genuinely like
they're criminals.
The movie thinks they are irredeemable.
Yes,
and I've seen this done well. The Crow,
is
a great example of this movie done well.
It's a super stylized movie.
Super stylized movie. It leans into the operatic quality of it. It's got, you know, the sort of literally coming back from beyond the grave adds this level of sort of ghostly campfire story, poetic justice to everything, and it gives you license to play those villain characters really, really over the top. But here, because it's not in that, like, really artificial world, every time they have these artificial elements, it's really fucking weird. The leader of the gang, the guy who is directly responsible for killing his son, and that's, like, the last person on his list, lives at the top of, like, a building, and it's Christmas. And he has, in the middle of, like, running a gang war tonight, has decked out the top floor with a whole lot of giant Christmas ornaments so that he can dance with his girlfriend. And I'm like, I cannot picture this guy going to Michael's or Joanne's and, like, picking out all of these decorations and saying, and telling his guys, that one goes there. No, raise that one higher. That'll catch the light. I can't imagine that. It's not that kind of a universe. Yeah. If this movie was really over the top, if this movie was really broadly drawn, if the characters were ridiculous, you could have gotten away with it. But you can't, because it's grim and it's gritty, and ultimately that just makes it leaden. It's dull. And there are some cool action-y moments in the last half, like a couple?
Technically, I suppose.
There's like a couple I was like, that's cool. I haven't seen someone do that with a car. Cool. All right, fine. It's not worth it. It's not like the action's so fucking phenomenal I could say, we'll see it for the action. I can't say that. And it's not that good.
And there are movies like that are really thin, but they just have a lot of really well thought out, brutal action sequences that are really well choreographed and filmed. So you're willing to forgive it.
Yeah.
sequences in, like, the Raid movies, for instance. Those movies don't have a lot going on.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of cool, broad stuff that you're going to be entertained through the end. Just watching people getting ripped apart. That's fun.
Yeah.
This is John Woo, and he's sleepwalking it. Like, he has no ideas that he's contributing to this.
The action
is not that interesting.
It's shallow material. Yeah. Like, even, you know, something like The Killer or Hard Boiled, you know, the plots are a little elaborate and Hard Boiled, but The Killer is relatively straightforward, but it really plays up the themes and the characters. And
was it The Killer with the blind person?
Yeah. At the beginning of The Killer, Chow Yun-Fat is a hitman. He goes on ahead and he's killing a bunch of guys. And then he accidentally, in the course of his mission, blinds a singer, a lounge singer. And he goes to her later and befriends her and falls in love with her. And he starts only doing jobs to pay for her surgery to fix her eyesight.
Yeah.
So it's about him trying to redeem himself, but he's only doing it through more murder. And there's a lot of irony there, and the idea of a cop who comes to respect him and vice versa. There's a lot of good sort of examination of macho bullshit in that movie. And it's great. It's a great fucking movie. But it actually is about things, and it cares about stuff.
I've always had a bit of an issue with the strange morality of a lot of these action movies. Sure. I'll murder 30 people. Oh no, but I blinded one other. Just murder that one too. Who cares?
Well,
you're just murdering a bunch of people. What's one more?
Well, again, that sort of limited morality is sort of like, that's why
I have lines I won't cross. You just killed 30 fucking people. What lines are left?
But none of them were under 18.
Yeah, it's like, okay. So as soon as you turn 18, you're free, fair game.
That's always
like,
I won't kill any kids. I'm like, but you'll kill all their parents.
Yeah. Kill the kids too. Why not?
I'm whatever. It's a weird genre, and we have come to accept a variety of things.
Point is, it's sex.
That is the point, isn't it? It's really disappointing. I was excited. It sounded like John Woo was trying something different, and he was actually trying something really conventional and drab, with just a slight gimmick. And honestly, like, here's the thing. No One Will Save You is a genre film about an alien invasion. It is about a young woman living on all alone in a town where no one talks to her as a plot point.
Yeah, she's
been justification. She's ostracized. Here, it's really distracting that no one's talking. And besides Joel Kinnaman. Joel Kinnaman, there's an excuse for his character, but like other people would probably want to communicate some things with him every once in a while. Yeah. And they don't even communicate with each other. There's a whole lot of plot points that are really fucking weird. Just because the movie has decided this is a world in which everyone's like super laconic. And it's a strange choice, and it just isn't justified by anything.
It doesn't strengthen or change the premise.
Yeah, and if the movie isn't heightened enough that you can just get away with just saying, it's a silent movie, and we'll make it look like a silent movie, and we'll evoke that. It's like, no, you try to justify it, but then all of the things you have to change to make that reality work aren't changed in a way that makes sense. So even the gimmick doesn't work, and that's annoying. Anyway, tell me about Eileen.
Eileen is the latest film from William Oldroyd, who did that film Lady Macbeth with Florence Pugh a couple years back.
Okay, cool.
I really liked Lady Macbeth.
You did.
And I really liked Florence Pugh in that movie.
You called it, by the way, when that movie came out. You're like, Florence Pugh's going to be a big deal.
Keep an eye on Florence Pugh, and I can be smug about that, because she's a big star now. Eileen takes place in Boston in maybe 1960. Thomasin McKenzie is the lead character. She's Eileen.
Yay!
And she has an intermittent Boston accent.
Okay.
They try to give everybody these like really broad Boston accents, and not everybody's doing it quite right.
Yeah.
Thomasin McKenzie is an English actress, so she's doing her best.
Okay.
Better than Thomasin McKenzie is actually really emerging as an actress who is like zeroing in on these really kind of wounded characters who have like a hidden rage in them, and that's certainly true of Eileen. Like you saw Last Night at Soho, right?
Unfortunately,
not a great film.
I didn't care for it.
No,
it's well photographed, I guess, but that's as far as it'll go.
I feel like Edgar Wright's kind of sauntering downwards as well, but in this film she plays a young woman who works at like as a secretary in a boys' prison.
Okay.
She's also like, everything's sort of unraveling around her. She lives with her father, who's played by Shea Whigham, and he's just grievously alcoholic. Like, he's drunk all the time. And the car she drives constantly smokes out of the radiator into the cabin.
Oh, that's
so there's, like, smoke coming out of the window.
They could die doing that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Everything's really just dangerous in her life. Yeah. And she is horny.
Oh.
Within the first, like, 15 minutes, there's two masturbation scenes.
Okay.
There's a scene, like, the opening scene is she's in this horrible car in the snowy climb at Makeout Peak, and she sees a couple going at it in the next car over. And she's, like, clearly hot and bothered. She reaches out of the car, gets a big fistful of snow, and shoves it down her pants. Like, she's got to cool off.
Like a steam noise and go.
That's like a Leslie Nielsen movie.
Okay, sounds like it.
And she, you know, she's having like these sexual fantasies about the guards in the prison. Like she's clearly like gritting her teeth in sexual frustration. And she goes home to this alcoholic father. There's no friendship or warmth in her life. Until, wouldn't you know it, Anne Hathaway comes in. And she's very glamorous. She looks like a movie star. She's got a big blonde wig. And she's going to be the psychiatrist at this local prison. And she's the only one who treats the Thomas and Mackenzie character. She's the only one who treats Eileen with any kind of warmth or kindness. And even says, hey, I don't know anybody in town. Can we go out for a drink?
Mm.
And Thomas and Mackenzie is, yes, I'm in love with lesbian Anne Hathaway. Let's do this.
Okay.
And it becomes this really kind of very intense sapphic romance, kind of almost in this potboilery pulp novel.
But,
kind of
actually, like, it's not subtext. It's actual text.
It's pretty text, because there's a scene where Anne Hathaway leaves the bar, and they go to the bar and they dance together. They don't dance with any of the men, and she leaves the bar, and Thomas Mackenzie runs back inside, picks up her cigarette butt, and starts smoking it. Like, there's this lustful connection between these two women. And a lot of sort of, she goes out, she misses her. A lot of this takes up maybe the first 70 minutes of this movie. And the movie's 97 minutes long. About 70 minutes in, that's when we introduce the story.
Oh,
there's
shit.
This big twist as to what's going on. And it turns into this kind of noir thing with a lot of, like, violence and unknowable moral things happening.
But, as soon as you said Anne Hathaway was blonde, I was like, is this a Hitchcock thing?
it's often a code in thrillers if you have a really prominent, very blonde. It's not a Hitchcock vibe, but there is a crime in progress that we learn about later in the movie, and I don't want to reveal what it is because it happens so late in the film. I feel like if they had gotten to that twist halfway through the movie, and we could sort of work through the crime a little bit longer, it would make a little bit more sense structurally.
Yeah.
As it is, I loved everything up until that moment.
Yeah.
And I actually did like sort of the moment after the crime. After the crime, we actually meet a criminal character. And I don't want to say who it is, because that's also a spoiler.
Yeah, yeah.
But they actually, we reveal what crimes have been committed, what's been going on.
Yeah.
And there's this wonderful monologue that the criminal character gives about, like, what their motivation was. And that's great. Mm. It's a great performance from that actor. But it's like a different, it comes out of a different movie.
Yeah.
We're not really sure where this is all supposed to be going, and then all of a sudden it turns into this almost like road trip, we gotta commit a crime and do something really desperate at the last minute kind of a story.
Whenever that happens in a movie, I think of Anthony Hopkins in Silence of the Lambs. No.
You were doing fine. Just have it be this sort of like sapphic potboiler, and I'm good, and I like that, but you're gonna read a lot of descriptions about Eileen that describe it as a noir or as a crime movie, and you're going to be waiting for it, and it comes really late in the film that it's a noir or a crime movie. Maybe they shouldn't be selling it that way, because that way it'd be a surprise.
Yeah. Well, like, that's the Genesis effect, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where you've got a plot point in your movie that is sadly the most marketable thing in your movie, but it happens so late it's considered a spoiler.
You're talking about Terminator Genesis.
Terminator Genesis, or another good example of this is the Wes Craven movie Red Eye, where the big plot twist happens 30 minutes into those movies. And you're not supposed to know that going in. But
there's no way to sell it otherwise.
You can't market the movie. You can't sell Red Eye, which is a story about Cillian Murphy like kidnapping Rachel McAdams on an airplane. You can't sell that movie and only tell people about the first 30 minutes, because they're going to think they're buying tickets to a romantic comedy and they're going to be mad at you.
Yeah.
So you have to tell them it's a thriller. But then that first 30 minutes, we're just waiting for the movie to catch up with us. Mm. And that sucks that you have to consider marketing when you're telling a story like this, but you kind of do.
Yeah. So, So I'm sorry to be that guy to reveal that this is a crime movie, but you're going to hear that it's a crime movie, and there's a crime in it, and I like the crime, I like that, but it's just the structure is a little bit odd. Yeah. More than anything, it's actually a really strong character piece.
Okay.
Thomasin McKenzie's really good in it.
So is Anne Hathaway.
Yeah, Thomasin McKenzie, she started when she was a kid, I think.
Leave No Trace.
Yeah. She's good in Leave No Trace.
Great in Leave No Trace. She's really good in Jojo Rabbit. She's good in everything, yeah. Notwithstanding.
I haven't seen her be quite this intense before. She's actually playing like a little bit more of a nuanced, complex, aggressive character, which I like.
Good.
I like the chemistry between her and the Anne Hathaway character.
Great.
She's starting to impress me as an actress, is my point. And I don't want to say it's a pity, because it's not a pity. It's just...
It doesn't quite come together well.
It doesn't cohere as well as it might have. There were just crimes. Structurally, yeah.
There are worse crimes than just, like, we did a thing and maybe it was a little rushed at the end, but pieces are still good. That's a way worse thing for a movie to be.
It's really the best way to put it. It's a little rushed at the end. If they just went on for, like, another 15 minutes or so, I really explored the falling action of what happened in that last part of the movie.
That's a good example.
It would have been a little bit stronger.
That's a good example of like why we have like our rating system at the end, because we spent a lot of time talking about this criticism, but it sounds like it really doesn't kill the movie.
No.
It just prevents it from being truly great. So the fact that we're spending a lot of time talking about the criticism doesn't mean that that it's a bad movie per se.
Yeah.
But let's get...
It's actually really gripping up into that point too.
So let's do a review roundup. Yeah. We review movies on a scale of C- to C+. An average movie would be a C, because that's how grades work. But a C+ is above average, and those are movies that we genuinely recommend. And then a C- is below average, and those are movies that we don't recommend for one reason or another. Whitney, Eileen.
Eileen, it's a C+.
Really?
I think even with the weird structure, it's a really good, strong character piece with great performances in it. And it's so atmospheric, and it's so well put together, and it's so well photographed. All of these things make it into a pretty solid film, and even after that twist, it's pretty exciting.
Yeah. Okay. Silent Night.
I might ask me tomorrow. I might change my mind.
Well, that's true.
Today I'm going to say C+.
In regards to Silent Night, you know, most gimmick movies actually try to do something with their gimmick, and I suppose the gimmick of Silent Night is that they didn't. So, it is a really kind of a big disappointment, and it does not work. I'm going to see my eyes.
Even if you didn't think this is John Woo, like even if it wasn't a disappointment, it's just a bad film.
It's just not good. If anyone directed this, I would say this is not very well done.
No, it's
a couple of okay action bits, but
you could pick up any super low budget B action film from 1986 out of a VHS bin somewhere and find an identical film.
Yeah, more or less.
It's about as good as that. The thing is with those B movie like action movies, they're usually made by like kooky guys on a shoestring.
They have personality.
And they're really trying to push something. So even those terrible B movies from the mid 80s are going to be better than this, which is trying to look really slick and serious.
All right. So C- is all around.
C-.
Candy Cane Lane.
I don't hate it. It's not a hateable film, but I don't really like it either.
Well, it's okay.
I'll give it a really high C-.
Okay. Forgiving
C-. It, like I said, does nothing offensive.
Yeah. Which doesn't do anything particularly good.
Gillian Bell's really good. I just want it to be funnier. I want it to be scarier. I want it to be something, have some more personality than it did.
All right. And then lastly, Godzilla Minus One.
That's a C+.
Yeah.
I did like Godzilla Minus One quite a lot.
Godzilla Minus One, I really do think it's a great take on Godzilla. That even though it kind of abandons the cynicism that's at the heart of the more serious Godzilla movies, it still works. It's still really, really rousing, good World War II melodrama that doesn't just happen to have Godzilla in it. That's not incidental. But it also centers around this incredible like pop culture icon and uses it to good effect.
Okay.
So it's definitely worth seeing. If you can see it in the theater, I do recommend it. It's a good spectacle film. But even if you can't, make sure whenever you get the opportunity, you check it out, because it's totally worth it. Next time, on Critically Acclaimed, we're going to review some movies.
We sure are.
Damn it. Is Poor Things coming out next week?
Poor Things comes out next week.
The new Yorgos Lanthimos movie. I think the new Hayao Miyazaki goes into wide release.
That's right. I think it's a limited right now, but we'll get it when it's
The Boy and the Heron. We'll be reviewing that next week.
Which they changed the title.
Yes, they did.
The original title, they were selling it as How Do You Live, which is a more literal version of the title.
Yeah.
And they changed it to The Boy and the Heron.
Yeah, that just happens. That happened with Suzumi, the latest film from the director of Your Name and Weathering with You. The original title was loosely translated, Suzumi is Locking Up.
Okay.
And they just changed it to the character's name, Suzumi.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's not so bad. That's not so bad, but it's also... I interviewed that director on the Slash Film, and we talked about that, how that like sort of changes the context of the film and what gets lost in translation and why he's kind of fine with that, actually, which is kind of a cool approach to it. So that's a really cool interview, and if you want to check that out on Slash Film, you can read it. Anyway, thank you everybody for listening. Thank you for joining us. Thank you to all of our patrons, without whom we couldn't do this. If you're a patron, you get to listen to our episodes ad-free. You also get a whole lot of exclusive shows. That's over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We're going to do an episode of We've Got Mail this week, and we're very excited about it. It's been too long. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, what is our P.O. Box? Yeah,
send us a physical letter to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yep, and we're on social media at Critic Acclaim. I am at all the social medias, at William Bibiani.
Same thing, but at Whitney Seibold.
And, yeah, I guess that's it. Never forget, everyone is a Godzilla.
I wanna go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?
A new year, time for new growth. Grow your education and skills with Herzing University. Our online behavioral health programs fit your schedule and time. From an 8-month diploma program in health and human services to a 36-month bachelor's in psychology. Grow your behavioral health career with us wherever you are in your education. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Visit us online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109. Online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109.